you know, and the next example, which I want to give, the next clip I want to play actually is from a Reverend Ibrahim Nasir of Aleppo, who delivered an open letter to President Obama in September 2012. And it's very interesting what he had to say. Remember, he is, even back then, I mean, Aleppo was a war-torn place, seeing that the war in Syria has been going on since the summer of 2011. It's been a long time now. But like I said last week, the most important factor for a communist in determining whether something is good or bad, good or evil, is the class that the person or movement or country or whatever serves. And this Aleppo reverend delivered a message that the Fortune 500 and their supporters in the Pentagon, CIA, White House, etc., definitely did not like. Hence why I didn't get any airtime on the mainstream media. And even now, like, has barely, you know, 800 views on YouTube. Because it did not get a lot of public, you know, airtime in the English-speaking world. But I want to rectify that at least slightly here tonight and actually play what this guy had to say. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
After what I have seen of destruction in Aleppo College, I have decided to send an open message to Mr. Obama. Dear Mr. Obama, President of USA, I was astounded previously when I have heard Reverend Jeremiah Wright insisting on one of his sermons that Christian community should sing, "Oh God, don't bless America anymore." But after what I have seen and experienced of destruction in Aleppo College, I have justified what he was saying. You know why? Simply because what I have seen in Aleppo College was incredible. You cannot imagine what had happened in that organization. Going back a little bit and remembering what Mrs. Clinton, your foreigner minister, have said previously to the gangs in Syria gives insight of what have discovered Reverend Jeremiah Wright was right. Mrs. Clinton asked the gangs to do not in Syria to do not give up their weapons, and she didn't give any effort to encourage them to go to dialogue with the Syrian government. In fact, she did the opposite exactly. She asked them to do not give up their weapons, and she asked them not to go to a dialogue with the Syrian government. You know, the policy that your government is adopting and that is building alliances with the fanatic groups in Syria and building alliances with governments and countries never knew democracy and freedom. Even the woman has no right to drive a car, put many questions marks in front of my eyes. Do you know that such policy encouraged these fanatic groups who produced a person called Ayman al-Shahabi to slaughter people by knife? Do you know that he confessed in one of the TV meetings with him that he used to say, "Praised be God who gave me the right to slaughter you by knife." Tell me, Mr. Obama. Tell me, Mr. Obama, in which Bible you have read to make such alliances? Please tell me, Mr. Obama, is that what you have learned from your church services? Tell me, Mr. Obama, is that what is your faith built on? To be honest, I am really asking many questions. Are you really Christian? Is that and such relationships our commitment to Jesus Christ our Lord? I cannot say yes. Let me tell you about what people we have and what people we educate. Before many decades, maybe two or three, a Syrian person immigrated from our country, Syria, to your country, USA. His name was Abdulrahman Zaytoun. Abdulrahman Zaytoun risked his life 40 times to save 40 American people, citizens, from Katrina tornado. This is how we educate our people in Syria. We are committed to our God who called us to save people and not to kill people. Abdulrahman Zaytoun became a model in your country. Even cinema interfered in that person, and they are now trying to produce a film that shows how this person could become a model, an example, and work for saving people. I invite you, Mr. Obama, to visit Aleppo, to visit Syria, and especially Aleppo College. This organization and school, which includes a school for elementary school, for elementary students, for preparatory students, and for secondary students. This school was established by American missionaries who came to this country and tried to educate people and give them sciences to improve this country and develop this country. While your alliances now is destroying this organization. Are you faithful to your ancestors? Or building alliance and thinking of the benefit of Israel destroys all things that were built in your life? Yes, please, Mr. Obama, and I am now sending a message to all Christian committed people around the world, in all the churches. Come and see. Come and see killing people in Syria in the name of God. Come and see destroying churches, sending bombs to churches. Do you know, Mr. Obama? We didn't worship our God in our church for 6 weeks now. We are going and visiting other churches to make our worship there. Mr. Obama, let me be honest with you. Many people are trying now to say that they are concerned about Christians in Syria. And recently I have heard Germany is preparing a plan to receive Christians from Syria. Honestly speaking, I am not concerned anymore about Christians in Syria. Because Christians and Muslims lived in Syria for more than 1,400 years. They lived together. Their relation is built on accepting each other, respecting each other. While, let me ask you, what your government policy and West policy has done, in Iraq? Most of the churches in Iraq were destroyed since you have your country invade Iraq. Now, most of the Christians were displaced from their countries and became refugees all around the world. And the real percentage now in Iraq doesn't equalize 10% of their previous percentage in Iraq under Saddam's regime. Mr. Obama, let me be honest. Now, I can understand Reverend Jeremiah Wright saying in his sermon. Now, I am telling you honestly that your policy, your government policy and the West policy in Syria is going to produce crucifixion for the community of Syria. Why? You are crucifying the Syrian people in the land that Jesus walked in it. Why? Why killing people in the land where Saul became Paul? Where he went to your country, to the West, telling you about the good news that Jesus Christ came to save us all. Mr. Obama, I invite you to come to Syria. I invite you to come to Syria and you see by your eyes and experience by your hands the catastrophe that your policy and West policy is bringing to our country. Syria is a civil country. Please don't let the uncivil policy you are adopting to destroy our country. This is my final words. Thank you.
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Reverend Ibrahim Nasir. His open letter, his open message to Obama, which he put out in 2012 in Aleppo. You know, it's pretty intense what he had to say there. You know, this is somebody who's on the ground in like a city that was at that time, you know, like also a battleground, being besieged by forces that Obama was backing and is backing, you know, these foreign-backed militants, you know, who were killing people close to this man. They've had a long record of actually killing Christians and other minority groups in Syria, you know, for sectarian reasons. You know, like this is the kind of thing that once again the Syrian army's up against. I mean, they're up against like forces that want to destroy the country, you know, and they're trying to defend a country which has had a long history, long proud history of being a homeland for many, many diverse groups and peoples, you know, going back thousands of years, you know, and you know, has been very accepting of people of different faiths and different backgrounds. You know, and really that's something that the Syrian army is defending, you know, like that that history of, you know, tolerance and acceptance and that unity of different, of diverse peoples in Syria. So I'm going to take another break and I'm going to be back after this short message. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Yeah, hi, this is Ariel Engel.
Hi, this is Andrew Whiteman of Aurora. Aurora, spelled A-R-O-R-A, not Aurora Borealis.
You're listening to
CFRU 93.3 in Guelph.
For many parents living in poverty, the back-to-school season is a time of financial stress and anxiety. For the children living in poverty, financial difficulties can cause feelings of isolation and hopelessness that may lead to dropping out of school. This year, Lakeside Hope House has teamed up with the Guelph Neighborhood Support Coalition to organize a citywide back-to-school backpack program. Together, we are working to ensure that as many children as possible receive brand new backpacks with those supplies needed for students to be fully prepared and confident. You can help us by sponsoring a backpack, raising supplies at your businesses, raising funds, or purchasing and donating supplies. If you would like to get involved, please contact Ursula via email at backpackproject@lakesidehopehouse.ca. Every little bit helps. I read it in the
paper. Hi, I'm Doug Blackwood. I've been hosting Seems Like Old Times for about 25 years now, featuring music and old radio memories from the 1930s to 50s. The show also focuses on issues and history-oriented subjects for older adults. If you know of something that would make a good topic of discussion or would like to hear a piece of music or old radio show repeated, why not email me at seemslikeoldtimes@cfru.ca. Seems Like Old Times, now on Sundays from 2 to 4 p.m. on CFRU 93.3 FM.
For many parents living in poverty, the back-to-school season is a time of financial stress and anxiety. For the children living in poverty, financial difficulties can cause feelings of isolation and hopelessness that may lead to dropping out of school. This year, Lakeside Hope House has teamed up with the Guelph Neighborhood Support Coalition to organize a citywide back-to-school backpack program. Together, we are working to ensure that as many children as possible receive brand new backpacks with those supplies needed for students to be fully prepared and confident. You can help us by sponsoring a backpack, raising supplies at your businesses, raising funds, or purchasing and donating supplies. If you would like to get involved, please contact Ursula via email at backpackproject@lakesidehopehouse.ca. Every little bit helps. I read it in the paper.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. Thought I would conclude the show once again by going back to a discussion of propaganda and media manipulation, which has been constant throughout the Syrian war, not only from Western media, but also from influential Arabic language channels based in America's Middle Eastern allies like Qatar. See, unlike its position during the Iraq war, Al Jazeera was intensely pro-regime change in Syria. And it's important to know how Al Jazeera in particular became a tool of American imperialism and foreign policy in the region, given its previous opposition to things like the Iraq war. Syrian journalist Ala Ibrahim and British journalist Lizzie Fallon go into all that and more in this interview that was broadcast in 2012 on Syria Youth English. So I'm going to play that, and that's going to kind of wrap up the show. So, and I'm going to be back next week for what may be the last show I do here, but we're going to make every minute count. So once again, please stay tuned to Back in the USSR and solidarity with all of you.
About what the people have been telling us.
What are the main points of view that you will be raising in this documentary?
Okay, so the main points is basically to deconstruct the main fabrications that have been put forward by the global media, mainly the Western media and channels, particularly Al Jazeera and Arabia. And these fabrications are that the army is on a mass scale, systematic scale, killing peaceful protesters. That there is no democracy in Syria, that there is no respect for human rights, and that there is no support for President Bashar al-Assad. So the documentary deals with all of these fabrications and in effect shows that actually in many of the cases they're just complete and outright lies.
You said that these are fabrications. For many of our viewers and people who would be watching us, when they hear the word fabrication, they would say, why would a TV channel, a leading TV channel, mainstream Arab media, fabricate news about Syria?
Okay.
And actually more than one, when you see five, six, or seven news outlets doing the same coverage. How would you explain that if they're fabrications, as you call them?
Okay, well, it's quite clear that in the West and in certain Arab countries, that the media is inseparable from the state, the government. So, for example, it's well known that the BBC is funded by the British state, Al Jazeera is funded by the Qatari state. So, in effect, it's very naive, actually, to think that these news organizations will report in a way that contradicts the foreign policy of their country. So we know very well that Qatar has been calling for foreign intervention in Syria very openly.
And very active in it, actually.
Has been very active, just as they did in Libya. I mean, what I'm talking about now applies exactly to Libya also. Britain, the NATO countries have also been pushing for intervention inside Syria. So it is actually the role of the media of these countries to provide a narrative that supports intervention inside Syria. So really, it is naive to think that these organizations are independent and that they have the ability to be objective. They are not independent, and they have to serve the foreign policy interests.
So, based on what you're saying, if the BBC is funded by the United Kingdom, if Al Jazeera is funded by the Qatari government, is Al Arabiya, if Al Arabiya is funded by the Saudi government, France 24, French government, and so on. So these are a translation of the policies of these governments and not free journalism.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. There's something very interesting for me that recently we've seen a shift in the coverage regarding events in Syria. Up to a certain point, no media outlets would acknowledge the presence of gunmen in protests in Syria. Everyone was saying that this is peaceful protest, that the security and the army is systematically, according to them, killing peaceful protesters. But when the observers, the Arab League observers, entered Syria, and for some reason the insurgents and the presence of insurgents became undeniable, we've seen a shift in coverage. They started justifying the presence of insurgents and justifying militants. Why do you think?
Well, I think there's two things. First of all, as you said, at the beginning there was completely no acknowledgement that the government was fighting against armed insurgents. It was all about the government attacking peaceful protesters.
Yes.
But as you say, now it's because of the Arab League have begun to acknowledge the presence. It has become impossible for this to be denied. And as you rightly say, there is the danger now that these armed groups are being legitimized. And I think this is because the NATO countries and other countries like Qatar, etc., they have been unsuccessful in pushing for intervention in the way that they want to do it, like via in how they did in Libya, via the United Nations Security
Yes.
Council. And so now they are looking to in creating this organization, which they call the Free Syrian Army, which I don't agree with the name of that, the name of that organization, but they're effectively trying to say that the Free Syrian Army or the armed insurgents are legitimate, and therefore it is legitimate for us to support them. And this is a very dangerous road to go down. It's a blatant violation of the sovereignty of an independent nation.
But even media outlets, let's take Reuters for example, they issued a report recently saying that only 3% of the so-called Free Army is made of army deserters, and mm-hmm. the rest is people who are wanted, or people who are wanted for prior crimes, or people who are simply thugs and they are bearing arms against the government. Mm-hmm. How do we judge these media outlets? We say they're not objective, they're not, but they're saying something which agrees with what's happening on the ground.
Yes, so on the one hand, this is what they're doing, and then on the other hand, they are still providing manipulative coverage on events in Syria. It's quite arrogant, actually, that they can come out and provide these reports of being honest about what is happening, but at the same time, they're not being critical about this. They're still facilitating hostility against the Syrian government. And really, I just think it's quite an arrogant approach towards covering the events in Syria.
As a percent, what percent did media contribute to the Syrian crisis, do you think?
At least above 90%. I mean,
90%.
It's clear that without the media's involvement in this conflict, the events would have been over, perhaps before they started. The reports at the beginning that the government was attacking peaceful protesters were crucial, I think, in mobilizing, in inflaming the situation inside Syria.
But many people say, why don't the Syrian government allow more journalists in? They allowed many journalists in. More than 160 news crews have entered Syria recently, actually, and many before in this crisis. Mm. But what do you think about the calls to allow journalists to enter Syria?
Well, as I said before, that the global media organizations are not separate from their governments, so there's first of all, I'd like to say that in Britain, if there was a similar crisis happening in Britain, it would be impossible. It would just be unheard of that if, for example, Britain was facing an aggression by, for example, Iran, it would be unheard of that Britain would be allowing Iranian media in the country, which is going to be critical of the British government. And indeed, even at a time of peace, when Britain isn't under threat from Iran, just a few days ago, Britain closed down the Iranian channel in English, which is an unprecedented move. It's the first time they've closed down an international channel. And it's evident that the reason that they're doing this is because they can't stand to have an Iranian voice in the English language. So really, I think that actually it's very generous of the government, Syrian government, to be letting any journalists into the country at all. Not only do they support the narrative of military intervention, but also it's been well documented, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but it's well known, and anybody can look into it, that media organizations, journalistic teams that come into countries like Syria and other countries that are facing war are embedded with intelligence. It's a very cheap way for imperialist countries to have eyes and ears on the ground when they can't send in, for example, special forces, which of course they do anyway. It happened in Syria, it happened in Libya, and it's happening now in Syria. And if I can talk quickly about the case of Gilles Jacquier in Homs.
The France 2 reporter who was killed in Homs by insurgents.
Exactly. At the shortly after he was killed, French media organizations were accusing the government of killing Gilles Jacquier. Actually, it's very complicated, and I can't go into a lot of the details because we don't have time. But before Gilles Jacquier came on the first delegation, France 2 sent a letter, and it's on the internet, this is all available for the public to see, sent a letter to the Syrian Ministry of Defense and Ministry of Information requesting that Gilles Jacquier be embedded with the Syrian military. And of course, the Syrian government laughed at this and rejected it because it's a very sensitive area for a French person to be,
or any foreigner to be affiliated with the Syrian army.
Even a Syrian person.
Even for a civilian, yes.
So there's also the Iranian engineers that were captured in Homs on December the 20th. Yes. Nobody knows what happened to them. It's very strange that a French magazine on January the 5th published pictures of these Iranian engineers, which shows that, the French magazine was Paris Match, which shows that they have contact, at least, with the people who have captured
with the insurgents,
their engineers.
Yes.
So when Gilles Jacquier was supposed to come, he came with his supposed girlfriend, a woman called Caroline Poiron, who is a photographer for Paris Match. When they went to Homs, it's well known that they were meant to be going to meet with opposition figures, and actually they requested that their Lebanese translator didn't accompany them later on when they were supposed to be going to either Baba Amr or Baba Spa. Why didn't they want her to accompany them? Obviously, there's something that they didn't want her to see. But then, of course, he was killed in an attack. Georges Malbruno from Le Figaro immediately accused the government. But then when evidence started to come out that actually Gilles Jacquier was a part of the military intelligence for the French, and of course this can't be proven conclusively, but there is evidence to suggest that.
But Le Figaro itself said that Gilles Jacquier was killed by an insurgency attack.
Exactly. So when the evidence started to come out to suggest that he wasn't who he said he was, then Le Figaro said that he was killed by insurgents. This is an extraordinary admission by the French, and actually they quoted some Free Army officials as saying this. So not only are the Free Army admitting to killing Gilles Jacquier, but they're also admitting to killing 8 Syrian civilians.
Exactly, which no one wants to speak about. They only want to speak about the French journalist.
Absolutely.
However, moving on to Libya, you were in Libya, you covered the events in Libya. Mm-hmm. What similarities do you find between the insurgency in Libya and the insurgency in Syria?
There are many similarities. There are, of course, many differences between the situations here and Libya, but in terms of
I'm just speaking about the aspect of insurgents, how they're managed, how the media cover their news and their activities.
Yeah.
Because in Libya, there has been something very interesting. They always told us that the so-called rebels, they're strong, they're determined, they want to do things, but every day we would hear about them losing more ground to government forces, and it wasn't until the NATO intervened, and it wasn't until the NATO intervened very strongly, actually bombing cities and everything that stands in the way, they weren't able to gain any ground from the government.
Yeah, well, of course, the media completely labeled these people revolutionaries, freedom fighters. But as we know, it's a similar situation in Libya. It's clear that they have strong links to Al-Qaeda and other Islamist groups. You're absolutely right in saying that they were in complete disarray, the rebels, and we can see that now, actually, in the way that there are many hundreds of different militias. There's no unity between these people, and they were completely incapable of doing anything without NATO. This is a fact. In terms of the other similarities in the media coverage, the media very much portrayed as though they had popular support. But actually, I was there, and I met a lot of refugees from places where they were heavily embedded, like Benghazi and Misrata. Thousands of people who had fled these areas because they were committing atrocities against the civilian population. And so to say that, of course, we saw footage of protests, you know, with these rebels, similar to how we are seeing now in Syria. In order to look at those images and say that that is popular support, when we can also see the atrocities that these people are committing, is it support or is it fear? You know, that is a judgment to be made. But the media was completely unquestioning about this, and they completely ignored the refugees, despite that they were there in Tripoli when I was there, and they were meeting these refugees, but they completely ignored them.
But many people would say like these are separate cases. They don't represent the whole militia or the whole armed rebels, as you call them. Why do you want to label the whole thing as they're committing atrocities against civilians?
I don't really understand the scale.
Why isn't, you said that you've seen violations of human rights committed by the armed rebels in Libya.
Mm-hmm.
But many people from other media outlets, they would say, yes, there have been atrocities. And they would say it's separate cases, like what happens in Homs right now in Syria. When insurgents kill civilians, they attack buses, they attack public buses, they abduct girls and they rape girls. And they say, but look, this is a separate case. This is not just the general case. How would you respond to something like this?
I mean, the atrocities that were committed were widespread. For example, from the beginning of the crisis in Libya, there was a policy of systematically targeting, in particular, black Libyans and other African migrants. And this was systematic. And we saw that when Tripoli fell, supposedly, or when NATO bombed the rebels into Tripoli, that we saw images, and the mainstream media couldn't ignore it, of dozens of black Libyans and other migrants
arrested,
being
detained,
captured and put on pickup trucks tied to poles. So to say that this is just an unfortunate consequence of the rebel is really naive and ignoring what is in front of your eyes and trying to whitewash the situation. If, for example, a Syrian soldier, legitimate Syrian soldier, kills a civilian, perhaps by accident, perhaps not, then the whole army is tarred with targeting civilians.
They
so why the double standards?
Killing.
Exactly.
Yes,
so why the double standards?
And you've said something very interesting. You said that insurgents didn't enjoy support. They enjoyed. They didn't command respect. They commanded fear.
Yeah.
Among the people, but some people would say, let's keep the insurgents, give them time, to work within the people, and the people would reject him eventually.
Mm-hmm.
The people will refuse to cooperate with them. The people would report them and turn them in.
Okay, of course there were some. There were some elements of Libyan society that did support the armed insurgents. I believe that they weren't. They were perhaps a little bit naive about who they were. But now, if you look just yesterday, there was a big protest in Benghazi. Where I think there was something like 4,000 people protesting outside the NTC headquarters. Mustafa Abdul Jalil's car was attacked, and I believe he was holed up in the building for about 4 hours. And there were many reports coming out where people were quoted as saying, you know, we fought for this so-called revolution, but actually probably things would have were better.
So, in your opinion, where are things going on the ground based on what you have seen in your recent stay in Syria?
Well, it's clear that there is a lot of popular support for the president here. There is a lot of... I get the sense that the people here are extremely tired with the crisis and want a quick resolution to the situation. But at the same time, I'm quite cynical because with the external parties, in particular Turkey, and the Lebanese, continuing to provide logistical and financial...
Some parties, of course,
support to these groups, then there's a big danger that the destabilization of the country will escalate. And at the same time, I don't have any faith that the West will take the pressure off. Syria is very important for them in terms of the later confrontations with Iran, Russia, and China. But then, of course, Syria is in a much stronger position than, for example, Libya, because of the support of the Russians in particular, and also the Iranians. So there is, of course, there is some aspects that give me a lot of hope, but there is also many things that make me quite cynical.
But also, if we speak about the media coverage, do you think there is any turning back? It seems that the media have went too far in portraying events in a certain way that they can't go back right now.
Mm. Well, there have been, as we mentioned before, there have been some more positive kind of, in terms of from a government point, Syrian government point of view, reports. For example, there was a report in The Guardian a few days ago which completely omitted that there was a lot of popular support for President Assad.
And there are fabricated YouTube footage that are being misused.
Exactly. A few months ago we never would have seen anything like that in The Guardian. So this is a positive development. But at the same time, as you say, the media has gone so far that it's very difficult for them to actually begin to be honest, because then they have to admit that they've been lying.
Is there any turning back from here? Yeah. Can they turn back and say, oh, look, we've made a mistake, we will change the way we're covering things?
They will never do that, especially while the West still wants war. As I said, the media's job in the West is to promote the foreign policy of their governments. If the West decides to take the pressure off, then they will find a way to get out of this hole that they've put themselves in. But they will never, of course, they will never admit that they've been lying.
If you speak about strategically about the events here in Syria, we're facing a situation where a great deal of misinformation is being prompted by many media outlets. How do you think we should deal with this in the future?
Mm. Well, for the Syrian people, it's very important for them to have a strong consciousness about the agenda of external parties in particular.
Yes.
and the media. But the crisis such as these and the one in Libya shows the importance of developing countries that are under attack from the West to develop extremely effective media that can counter the overwhelming power that the Western media and organizations like Al Jazeera have, and not just in their own languages but also in other languages, because no matter how many people you have telling the truth, it's sad to say that just the sheer marketing power of organizations like BBC, CNN and Al Jazeera, no matter how many times they're proved to have lied, people will always believe them because they have this strong brand and marketing power.
And this is a very important question. Why do people continue to believe these channels, though they have been proven to be lying in various occasions? CNN declared that it has broadcasted footage from Syria that was untrue. Not only that, they broadcasted footage of the Syrian army attacking towns, while in fact it was footage of the Syrian army being attacked by insurgents in some areas. They acknowledged this, and yet people still believe them. Al Jazeera also, in many occasions, they lied. The case of Zainab al-Husni, mm-hmm. they said she was killed, she mm-hmm. was alive. Why do people keep believing these channels?
I call it because of Western cultural supremacy.
Yes.
And that, you know, unfortunately, we are so... the culture of the West is so deeply embedded in people's minds and hearts that even though we know that it's lying, because it looks a certain way and because we've grown up believing that this is right, it's essentially it's brainwashing. And as I said, it's the power of marketing. You know, people spend a lot of money understanding how to make people believe that black is white and white is black. So it's very important that countries like Syria, Russia, China, and other countries that face this kind of propaganda also invest in marketing to be able to counter that.
Well, they established channels. The Iranians have the Press TV channel, Syrian TV mm-hmm. has service in foreign languages, Russia has Russia Today, Latin America has Til Sur, but for some reason we're not seeing any progress, any thoughts, anything developed on the ground.
Yeah, but while these channels produce very good content and perhaps more objective reporting, more honest reporting,
yes.
again it comes down to marketing. They don't invest so heavily in the marketing and the brand because they believe that the content of their work will shine through, but unfortunately this isn't the case.
You paint a very dark image. Journalists who are associated with intelligence services, channels who are carrying out foreign policies of their countries, and unaware and maybe uncaring public opinion. Is there any light at the end of that tunnel?
Well, we have to learn from these situations, you know.
Yes.
And as I said, we have to build our own. We can't rely on other countries' media to tell us. I'm talking, saying us, but of course it's you. The Syrian people can't rely on other countries' media to tell
their story.
You have to have your own voice, and you have to. But really, you have to learn what is happening, and you have to understand what is happening and why it is happening. Why are we not focusing on Bahrain? Why are we not focusing on the protests in Saudi Arabia? And this is because of imperialism and the imperialist control of global media and global culture, and you know, global economy.
Hoping that we would overcome this crisis and take some of the advice that you have spoken about into consideration and into action. Thank you very much, Lizzie Phelan, a journalist from the United Kingdom, for being with us in tonight's edition of Overseas.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And for you, our viewers, thank you for being with us in tonight's edition of Overseas. Hope to see you again next week. Bye-bye.
So everybody, this is Michael Parenti, progressive scholar based in Berkeley, California. And actually, Michael, I would like to talk to you right now about you have your latest book, which came out earlier this year. It's called The Face of Imperialism. Am I right?
Correct.
That is correct. Okay. So I would like to begin just by asking, what is the... you could say the face of imperialism in the modern world, you know, based on the title of your book there. Because, you know, the picture that we get, you know, that a lot of people have of empire, of imperialism, is they think the old bygone colonial empires of the, say, the 19th century and whatnot, they think of it almost as an anachronistic concept. So what does imperialism look like today?
Well, in fact, in the literature today, it's not anachronistic. There are book after book using the term empire. Twilight of Empire, Follies of Empire, The Search of Empire, and all sorts of... And they're all about how America has a global dominion and has a mission and is doing something that's very right or very wrong or whatever, but in any case mistaken and such. And I argue that the U.S. empire is very rational, it's very successful, it's led by people who know what they're doing. And what they're doing is to expropriate the land, the labor, the natural resources, and the capital. And and the trade of the entire world, expropriate all of that for the profits of the multinational corporations to make the world safe for the Fortune 500. And they're very successful at what they do, and they're very rational. And the dictators in the Middle East, for instance, who support that arrangement, who bring in the IMF, who open up their country for U.S. investments on terms that are totally advantageous to the investors at a cost to their own people, their own farmland, their own farmers, their own consumers, their own workers. Those dictators are supported. They're called friends of the United States. Mubarak was called that, right, to the last, until he couldn't be legitimately supported anymore.
Oh, yeah.
But Obama and Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton were calling him a friend who had stability and all that. He was a dictator for 30 years, but he was their dictator, you see. But now the dictator, and the other kind of dictator, the one who has some idea of self-development for his country and self-determination, someone who refuses to deal with the IMF, who uses the resources, the oil earnings of the country, kicks out the oil companies like Gaddafi's done in Libya, kicks out the oil companies and uses the earnings for free housing, free education, for building up that marvelous public aquifer from the south of Libya, bringing up all that beautiful, clean, pure water for consumption and for farming and development. A leader like that is demonized. Hello, are you there?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. A leader like that is demonized in the U.S. media, and the demonization of the leader justifies then, gives the empire license to bomb and kill his people. That you demonize Noriega and you can invade Panama and kill people there. 3,000 people bombed and killed in El Chadi, a working class neighborhood. You demonize Milosevic and you can bomb for 78 days and nights. Bill Clinton did bomb Yugoslavia and break it up. And I was in Yugoslavia 2 weeks after all the bombing ended. And I saw the terrible destruction that took place there. It was privatization by bombing. They hit only state-owned auto utility factories, hotels, and such. Only the state-owned ones. The private ones went unscratched, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So this empire is there dedicated to making the world safe for big private capital.
Mm-hmm.
And corporate capital, and that's what it's about. Instead, what we get is a literature which says how U.S. policy is confused, how it's inept, how it's well-meaning but misdirected, how it has a messianic mission that's leading it astray, how it's beset by unintended consequences, how it's this and that. And, of course, sometimes there are unintended consequences. I'm not ruling that out of history.
Oh, yeah.
But I argue in the face of empire that, in fact, it's not inept. It's not the people who own and control most of the world, you know, are not inept. They're getting richer and richer, and the people, the ordinary people of the world, are getting poorer and poorer. The number of people living in poverty in the world is growing at a faster rate than the world's population, which is growing quite fast as it is.
Yeah.
So you see, things aren't getting better. And we see that same thing right within the U.S. People say to me, why, you mean American policy, they would go and do all that just to destroy these people's social programs and privatize everything in their countries and expropriate all their resources and increase the gap between the rich and the poor? You think that's what the policy is dedicated to in all these corners of the world? I said, well, that's what it's dedicated to in the U.S. That's what free market policy is about here. That's exactly what they're doing here. They're cutting back on social programs. They cut back on taxes to the rich. They cut back. Wages have gone flat and not keeping up. And meanwhile, the super rich get richer and richer, and the rest of us must work harder and harder to stay in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
If you're working harder and harder to stay in the same place, you're not staying in the same place.
Not staying in the same place.
You're slipping back, yeah.
Well, certainly what I've seen, you know, being up here in Canada, you know, we're seeing the rise of a conservative right wing that's, in many cases, trying to demolish the gains that have been made by working people over the years, and you know, almost move us closer to like what you're seeing, I guess, in the United States.
Yes, rolling and, back the gains that have been won, mm-hmm. hard fought gains.
Yeah, and it's quite sad to see them, you know, really making a very, very serious and quite frightening bid for power in Ontario itself, which is where I am. And of course, they've already gained a majority in Parliament, but yeah. Well, one of the things I really wanted to talk about was indeed Libya. And because in Libya, certainly, I think it was on RT just the other day, RT America, which actually broadcast, apparently the, you know, the bombings, the effect of the NATO bombings, which of course has been catastrophic on the infrastructure of that country. The only thing they have not hit has actually been the oil refineries. You know, that's like the only thing that remains untouched in a lot of these places, like, say, Brega or Ashdabia or
these other places. Right. They're anticipating taking over the oil countries, but oil industries,
infrastructure. Yeah,
right. So yes, in Libya and under the guise of humanitarian war, which is to go in and stop the savage slaughter of innocents, supposedly by the Gaddafi people. Well, by the way, charge that's never really been proven.
Right.
You know, but so they've been bombing the utilities, they've been bombing the factories, they've been bombing the ports, the transportation systems. They're destroying the country and they've been killing a lot of innocent people.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been committing acts of war. Those are all acts of war when you bomb a country, bomb its facilities, and kill its people. And they also have perpetrated a blockade of Libya. A blockade is an act of war. When one country blockades another country, that first country is committed an act of war. Because what you've done is you've cut off the other country's lifeline to all commerce and whatever else. You're committing an act of aggression,
mm-hmm.
against the other country's commerce and ability to survive.
And that's
what's happening,
yeah.
Now. And we have so-called progressive people who are lined up and are standing,
mm-hmm.
shoulder to shoulder,
oh, yeah.
with the CIA and the Pentagon and the White House and NATO and the major media, who they always tell us don't believe and be critical of, and they themselves are believing every damn story that's come out. They're believing it. They got Susan Price, U.S. ambassador, who says Gaddafi feeds his troops Viagra before they go into battle.
I've heard that.
They're better able to rape. What level of story is this? It's like the crap we used to hear with Yugoslavia, that there was a Serbian general who told his troops, go forth and rape. And those of us who said, what general? Where did this happen? What were the army units that were asked to do? Nobody came up with anything. It was
where's the evidence?
Thing. It was just a story fabricated, and it's repeated again and again. And this is what they do. And these are called humanitarian wars. And these leaders are demonized, and there are some people on the left, some of them just think they're fighting the ghost of Stalin, I guess, I don't know. Others who just think they are, for some reason, they just believe the bourgeois capitalist media without a second thought.
Mm-hmm. So one of the other things I really wanted to mention, of course, was Greece, you know, what's going on there. Because, I mean, does that factor into your study of imperialism, you know, where you have the IMF actually going in and essentially doing this whole, like, privatization campaign, really, you know, essentially forcing, you know, the government of a country really to do its bidding in that sense and just, you know, essentially demolish, you know, every human service you can possibly think of. You know?
Right, and that's
not necessarily war.
Privatize everything. Yes, that's exactly what they were doing in Libya, too, but it wasn't going fast enough, and there wasn't enough of it, and Gaddafi was managing to still keep the other gains that he had won in the first 30 years. But he saw what had happened to Iraq, and so he got so frightened that he started making SAPs, too, you know, structural adjustment programs, which meant concessions and the amount of money spent for human services and all that, and he began to do some privatization or giving capital some more room. BP was going to have a consortium with him on the oil. So he was making these concessions, but it wasn't enough. It wasn't really a free market sweep, and that's what they're going to do. And they're using Greece the same thing. Greece is going to get a bailout. Well, there's no bailout. You know what a bailout is? It's just a debt, that's all. It's just lending more money to the country, but it's not... it's not in any way helping Greece. And you lend the money, it's kind of blackmail. You know, we'll give you the money to meet the payments, and what you got to do now is hand over all the communication industry, the transportation industry, anything that might be in the public domain. And these are the very thing. These are the things that have to be wiped out because they're socialistic. And it's a funny thing. What they demonstrate is that socialism works. A socialized post office works more efficiently and better than a privatized one. I remember the U.S. post office used to be completely publicly owned. It wasn't broken up in sectors and all that.
Right.
It was publicly owned, and used to get deliveries two times a day, 6 days a week, and it was fine. It was one of the best postal services there are. Today it's much tougher on workers, much more expensive, and much of it is going into private hands. And that process of privatizing the post office started with Nixon. Well, it showed the post office worked better when it was socialist. Railroads in Europe work better when they're government-run and government-owned than Amtrak when it's privately owned and it's milked. It's milked for private profit. How can you expect to get something good out of a system like health service or transportation or hospitals and such, when the function or schools, when the function, the primary function, is to extract as much profit as possible by private corporate owners? Then you're not going to get the kind of services you need. Private ownership might be better for, you know, a specialty restaurant or something, or some other, I don't know, a fashion house or something.
Yeah.
Or some small service businesses. I can see where private ownership might have a role and small business might have a role. But the problem with capitalism is their enmity towards socialist or publicly owned services. What they hate about publicly owned services is that they do work, and that's why they don't want them. That's why they're trying to destroy Social Security in the United States.
Because
it does work. It's the most successful anti-poverty program that we have in this country. You never miss a Social Security check. The administrative costs for Social Security are about 2% of the total intake on it. I mean, vastly less than private insurance. Private insurance is more like 20-30%, because that has to go for profits, advertising, and all the stuff that they do. So this is what the war is. It's really a war to defend, extend, and expand the free market capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, most of the people, even people who say they are left and progressive and such, don't seem to understand that or ever carry it that far. Instead, they talk about how stupid this president is, or how silly that is, or how contradictory these are. You know, here's one dictator you support, and there's another dictator you oppose, and why can't they be as smart as we are? And the fact is, they're really stupid. They don't know what the hell they're talking about half of the time, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, yeah, and you can see, of course, this process in your own communities. I mean, in our own communities, considering that, Canada, one of the things it's absolutely renowned for is, of course, this whole, like, single-payer, publicly-owned healthcare system.
Right.
And, of course, that's being undercut. Of course, it's been under attack in Ontario for quite a long time. I know when I was a kid, certainly is a point in this, the town I'm in, Guelph, had two hospitals, two emergency wards, you know, and it was much smaller then. Now, of course, it's a city of 120,000 people and growing, and it only has one emergency ward. You know, that was because of the cuts made by a conservative government for really the reasons you just pointed out. So, you know, it's like these left critics, I mean, like, we see this everywhere. And, honestly, I think we should open our eyes.
The same thing in the UK, right?
In
Britain, the private utility companies, electric companies, the top managers got their salaries doubled and tripled and quadrupled. The services were cut back and were inferior to what they had been before, and the rates were much higher. So you're paying more and getting less. That's what the secret of capitalism is.
Oh, yeah.
And they talk about how the free market can do it better. it can't. What it can do better is put up a big cloud of propaganda about what it supposedly does or doesn't do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually want to shift gears now, because there was another thing I actually wanted to talk to you about. Because we know this is very relevant, what you you talked about with the face of imperialism. You know, you've shown how relevant that is in the present day here. But I want to talk to you about kind of more historical book, which you wrote, of course, back in 2003, I believe it came out, which is the Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome, which I actually talked about back in March. I had my co-hosts here, and we actually did a whole show, more or less analyzing Julius Caesar as a popular leader, back then, kind of like this reformist figure, which of course not many people know him in that light. But I wanted to know what really inspired you to, explore that, because it's one of those things that's not immediately obvious. Like, everybody thinks they know what the score is with Julius Caesar. You know, he's like this this guy who destroyed the Roman Republic, and he was like this evil, you know, guy who wanted power for power's sake. And that seems to be, you know, the common opinion, you know, displayed by historians all across the board. So what was it that ultimately led you to do that work, to write that book?
Well, Siegfried, the only thing I find more intriguing and exciting than learning history is unlearning history.
Mm.
That is, unlearn the things that I thought were true and suddenly discovering, wait a minute, wait, that isn't it at all. And we were taught that Julius Caesar was murdered by these aristocrats because they so loved their beloved republic and he was usurping power. And that was nonsense. These guys backed every emperor that came afterwards.
Mm.
They supported the emperors because the emperors never imposed taxes on their wealth, never imposed luxury restrictions, never forced them to hire free labor instead of slave labor, never imposed rent controls on the big tenement houses they owned in Rome, never imposed on them land reform and giving the land back to small landholders. And Caesar did all the